are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
Well, good evening on this March 4th, 2010. And welcome to Education Now. Tonight we're going to hear an interview with Jennifer Engel from the Education Trust. But before we go into the interview, I thought it would be good to give you some background into the Education Trust. Their mission statement, for instance, reads, "The Education Trust promotes high academic achievement for all students at all levels, pre-kindergarten through college. Our goal is to close the gap in opportunity and achievement that consign far too many young people, especially those from low-income families or who are Black, Latino, or American Indian, to lives on the margins of the American mainstream." And they say, how do they plan to advance their mission? They say, although many organizations speak up for the adults employed by schools and colleges, that they speak for the students, especially those whose needs and potential are often overlooked. They evaluate every policy, every practice, and every dollar spent through a single lens, what is right for students. They say they carry out their mission in three primary ways. They work alongside educators, parents, students, policymakers, and civic and business leaders in communities across the country, providing practical assistance in their efforts to transform schools and colleges into institutions that serve all students well. Well, that would be great. They say that we analyze local, state, and national data and use what we learn to help build broader understanding of achievement and opportunity gaps, and the actions necessary to close them. And they say they participate actively in national and state policy debates, bringing lessons learned from on-the-ground work and from unflinching data analysis to build the case for policies that will help all students and schools reach high levels of achievement. Their core beliefs are the belief in the power of education to close the gaps that separate low-income students and students of color from other young Americans. They say they believe that schools and colleges, appropriately organized, can help virtually all students master the knowledge they need to succeed. And they say they believe in long-standing gaps in opportunity, achievement, and attainment have roots inside and outside of schools. And though they know these gaps are stubborn, they also know they are not inevitable. And they believe in a strong education improves the lives of young people, and it's vital to sustaining our democracy and strengthens America. And I couldn't agree more. So there's a little bio on the Education Trust. Now, for a bio on Jennifer. Jennifer joined the Education Trust in August of 2008 as an assistant director of higher education. She came from the Pell Institute for the Study of Opportunity in Higher Education, where in 3 years she rose from project manager to senior research analyst to acting director. As the Pell Institute's senior research analyst, she engaged in quantitative and qualitative research activities, including survey instrument development, data collection and analysis, and writing on issues affecting the post-secondary opportunity and outcome of low-income first-generation students. She holds a doctorate in education from American University. She has held research and teaching positions at American University, Trinity University, Montgomery College, and the American Association of University Women. Other professional experiences span program evaluation and curriculum design. So there's a little bio on Jennifer herself. So now why don't we go into the interview, and then I'll be back with you to give you contact information and do a little bit of analysis ourselves. Here we go. Hello, Jennifer Engels, and welcome to Education Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wanted you to talk about the 50 flagship universities that the Education Trust has been doing a report on. And tell us, what are those 50 flagship universities, and why are you singling them out?
Certainly. Here at the Education Trust, our focus is on closing achievement gaps from pre-K through college. And when we look at our education work in particular, we often take a very hard look at public institutions in particular, because public institutions have, as part of their mission, the need to serve the full diversity of their state residents. They are the option for so many students, particularly students coming from low-income and minority backgrounds. Looking at the flagship universities, these are typically the premier public institution in their state. So this is the institution that affords particularly high-achieving students the opportunity to get an excellent education, a high-status education at an affordable cost. And when we set out to do this study, it was actually an update of a study that we did in 2006, where we asked the same question, which was, how well are these premier public institutions, the top public institution in the 50 states, how well are they serving the low-income and minority populations of their states? And unfortunately, the answer then, as it is now, is they're not doing very well.
They're not doing very well. And that just doesn't surprise me. And could you talk now specifically about California? What would some of the flagship universities in California be? I'm sure they'd be part of the UC system, like I'm sure that they would be. And could you tell me how they're doing compared to the others, and just generally how they're doing?
Certainly. When we take a look at UC Berkeley is who we chose as the flagship university of California. Obviously, there are a number of others that stand out in the UC system, but we chose UC Berkeley as the representative here in this study as the flagship. What we see nationally is that there's a lot of work to be done on access for minority and low-income students. There are gaps when we look at the success of minority students versus their peers, and we haven't seen much progress over time. That's the national story. When we look at UC Berkeley in particular, they score below average relative to the other flagships on minority student access. When we're looking at minority groups, we're looking at underrepresented minority groups. So this finding might surprise folks, given that there are a large number of Asian students served at UC Berkeley. But when we look at the underrepresented minority groups, Latino, African American, and Native American, we see that UC Berkeley is not serving them in a proportional way relative to the number of them in the high school graduates coming out of California. So we see that they're below average on minority access. Berkeley actually does very well on low-income student access, though. They do above average relative to the other flagships, and they do above average on minority success. So while they do still have a gap between their white students and their minority students, that gap is smaller than we see typically at the other flagships across the country, and they've improved on this measure over time as well, largely because the success rates of minority students have gone up quite a bit since our previous report. So overall, when we look at Berkeley, we see that they are among the top performers of the flagships on these metrics, except on minority access because of those gaps for Black and Latino students in particular.
I would think that the defeat of affirmative action several years ago would have a great deal to do with the report, because when affirmative action died here in California, the hopes and dreams of a lot of youth of color, evaporated, especially in institutions like Berkeley, which is so prestigious. Now, I happen to favor a smaller environment, even at the university level, especially for students who, where their self-concept is really important to their success. But I think it's having access is so important, especially since Berkeley has this the status that goes with it. A lot, if you go to Berkeley, then that's supposed to give you added status, even if it, in terms of an environment to go to school in, and in terms of the personal involvement that you can have there, is mm-hmm. not as great. It's great perhaps for graduate school, but as an undergraduate, I question that. I question that Berkeley would be the place to go. And you would think that they'd have a much greater population of Black and Latino students, especially given Oakland, that Oakland is there. But as I say, when affirmative action died, we saw a lot of changes in the systems in California. It was just like another obstacle.
Definitely. There's been a lot of research to that effect that shows that it has had a detrimental effect on access for Latino and African American students. And I think also, the current budget crisis in California is only exacerbating that problem even further. UC and CSU are both, increasing tuition and cutting enrollment in response to the budget crisis. And what we see is that the students who are most vulnerable, the low-income students and the underrepresented minority students, get pushed down out of the UC system into the Cal State system, or from Cal State down to the community college system, or out altogether. I was just reading today that the community college system in California has actually had a dip in enrollment because they don't have enough funds and they've had to cut course sections. So those students who might be able to get into a UC or even a CSU are not able to afford right now, and the system's not able to afford them either.
Yes, it's so sad. Since Proposition 13, that's when it all started crumbling, in my opinion. And then there was this promise from the community colleges that 2 years at the community college, if you did well, that was guaranteed access into the UC system. And that was so hopeful. But then on the other side, you have this destruction of affirmative action. You have this stress on the system financially, and just to the very people that needed in order to be able to go to school. And last month our show was on the children of immigration, and so this is just another piece of the whole picture. And I know that there are students that went through high school with me who are still paying off their Pell Grants, even though they're, they've been out for like 10 years. And it's just mm-hmm. gotten worse. It's just gotten worse. So I can't even imagine how difficult it must be for students of color and for students who come from poverty in this financial climate and in this political climate.
And this was an issue we focused on in the report as well, because while we see that, we see tuitions increasing, there still is money in institutional grant aid that institutions have the discretion of how to award that money. And what we did, we didn't have data on the individual flagships themselves on this. We had to look at some aggregate information that was available to us. But when we look at public research universities like the flagships, what we find is that they're choosing to spend about as much of their grant aid on students in the highest income quartiles as they're spending on students in the lowest income quartiles. And the reason is that they're using this grant aid to attract students of a certain academic background in order to increase their selectivity, increase their position in the rankings, because they get credit for who they exclude in these rankings. And so they're trying to attract and really buy a certain type of student to improve their standing that way. In the meantime, we see that low-income students attending public research universities tend to have about $10,000 in unmet financial need. So even after you apply Pell Grant, even after you apply a state grant, and after you apply the institutional aid that they get, the institutional grants that they get, they still come up about $10,000 short in terms of the total cost of attendance. And that equates to about 70% of their family's income, because these are our lowest income students. That means they have to make up that $10,000 through additional work, through additional loans. Both of those can put students at risk of not completing because they're putting so much time into their work in particular.
Isn't that pathetic when you think of the promise and when you think of where we were? I know when I tell my students, they say, well, we weren't around then, so we don't understand. And I say, well, when I moved to California in 1967, education was free. College was free. And it was second only to New York in the nation. Now it is 47th in the nation, and it is so difficult to go. And if you choose to go and you want to take the whole spectrum of classes and be well-rounded, then, you know, instead of rushing through, then there's a penalty because it costs more. Instead of wanting you to be well-rounded, as well as good in math and science, as mm-hmm. well as wanting you to be an informed citizen, you know, which is should be the goal of education, it's very frustrating for me, which is why I do this radio show or this broadcast. So
definitely. Well, and I think, you know, to that point, we see that, you know, the conversation around low-income and minority students getting access to higher education, we see a big push to serve these student populations in the community colleges and have that vocational focus in particular. But what our research shows in this report and what other folks have shown in their research is that there are a large number of low-income and minority students who are high-achieving students. These are students with good grade point averages coming out of high school, with good SAT scores. They're qualified to go to these premier public institutions. They're qualified to go to a Berkeley. They're qualified to go to the other flagships. And what happens is they end up undermatching. They end up going to a less selective four-year institution than they're qualified for. They end up going to a community college when they could get into a Berkeley. And part of the reason is, you know, the financial issue in particular. But what we see is that it really reduces these students' chances of graduating. Community colleges and less selective four-years have much lower graduation rates on average than the public flagships. And so it does a real disservice to low-income minority students to make the argument that they're best served in a community college setting and with that vocational focus, when we know there are so many of them out there who have the talent, they have the drive, they just don't have the means, and they don't have the support networks that the more advantaged students have.
Right. I know that if you were going to go, say, from here, I live in Northern California, which is rural, and you were going to go to Berkeley to school, and you were poor, or black and Latino and poor, then you would have to pay to live there, which is one another huge expense. You would not have the support system that you had when, you know, if you went to community college here. Mm-hmm. And so the promise that if you went to community college here and you really focused, and we have great teachers, that you could get into the university of your choice, of the UC system, you're saying to me that that's really a false promise.
Right now it is. because the success rates are so low coming out of the community colleges, in the work that we did with our with another project here at the Education Trust, what we find is that fewer than a third of students come out with any credential or transfer to a four-year institution within 4 years out of the community college sector. And when you look at the rates for minority students, it's closer to 25%. So, you know, right now it is a false promise. You know, I think there is potential to improve our community college system in a way that it can become that access point and become that transfer point. But right now the data don't support it, and there's too many students whose college dreams will die in the community college if they don't have access to these other institutions.
That's for sure. I had a private school, and as a private school, I would use the community college for advanced, you know, honors classes, and and it worked beautifully well for my students. And of course, then they were even more prepared to go on to the university system. And I don't really care for the way that so much stress is put on the tests, on the SAT, which I think is bogus, but and not so much on can the student write a paper, can the student is the student well-rounded?
Mm-hmm.
Those to me seem to be a much higher priority than this test that they're using. And then the population of Berkeley, how huge it is. I just don't know. I know that it has a fabulous reputation, and I know that it's very prestigious to attend. But I really question that that's really accurate, that it is the best road for students.
I think it can be for some students, and certainly we think, you know, that's why it's important to have those different sectors available to different students. But we certainly think that there's no reason why a flagship university shouldn't reflect the full diversity of its state's population, given that we know those talented students are out there not getting access. And we also think that public flagships have a mandate to do that as well.
Now that was the goal of affirmative action. If affirmative action was in place, then Berkeley would reflect the diversity of California and not be skewed the way that you're presenting that the statistics are. Yes, well, I don't know. Are there some plans in the works to address this? Is there hope?
Well, I think, you know, one of the issues that we focus on in this report in particular is the financial aid issue and the fact that institutions can choose to use their financial aid differently than they do now. They can choose to meet the full financial need of low-income students in particular. And so I think that's one place that institutions can start and where they have a lot of control and can make a different choice. They also were part of a large initiative called the Access to Success Initiative, and we're working with a number of state higher education systems all across the country, including the Cal State system. The UC system is not part of this initiative, but we think that even institutions and systems that are not part of this initiative can sign on to or commit to the kind of goal that the rest of these systems have, which is to cut their access and success gaps in half by 2015 for low-income and minority students. So we think there's a real leadership aspect to making this a priority. We know this is the demographic future of the country. We know that low-income and minority populations are growing. They're the future college-going population, they're the future workforce, and we need to make a commitment now to better serving these students in our colleges and universities.
Oh, that's great. I wish that you had some hope for the undocumented students who are prepared and eager to attend as well, but that's a whole other topic.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, you do have some solutions in this plan, which is exciting, and I hope that you get a good response from the universities that you do contact. And I do see the state universities, some of them as being really great, and I think UC Davis is also a part of the UC system like Berkeley is a great school, and you know, from my experience, and also UC Santa Cruz and UC San Diego, those are the schools that in the UC system that that I've been aware of that really offer a nice whole, the whole works, that don't funnel students too early into a specific category. And I hope that all of them will try to address offering this to more students who are from low income, but really who are students of color, because that's what you're saying, is that even the low-income students are having a better time of it than the students of color.
Mm-hmm. At least with respect to Berkeley. Mm-hmm.
With respect to Berkeley. So that, and you'd think that, especially at Berkeley, that claims to be so progressive, that that issue, even with affirmative action dying, that they would have let that issue go down so easily, be taken apart. Well, thank you very much for sharing this information with us, Jennifer, and for the work that you're doing there at the Education Trust.
Thank you so much.
You've been there since 2008, right?
Yes.
Yes, and it's meaningful work, and you think that you'll be able to help them make some changes for our country and for education.
We do. We hope so. And more importantly, we know there are already colleges and universities doing that work, and we hope to shine a spotlight on those that are making the changes.
Could you mention those? Could you talk about
Certain, well, I actually am near my time here in terms of needing to go, but we do highlight a number of them, a few of them in the report that have shown some good changes over the period that we looked at in these two different studies. University of Florida being one of them that's made some progress, and also SUNY at Buffalo made some progress in their minority student graduation rates. But we also have some additional resources on our website, the educationedtrust.org, and a website called collegeresults.org, where you can look up almost any four-year institution in the country and get to look at their graduation rates in comparison to a peer group, a similar group of institutions, so you can see how well they're serving their students overall, as well as their students from different racial and ethnic backgrounds. So I would encourage you to look at the resources that we have there as well, and your listeners as well. We highlight some institutions in the work that we do with our College Results Online work as well that would be useful.
Oh, thank you so much for those contacts. Well, there you have it. Our interview with Jennifer Engel, and which I enjoyed very much. Of course, I did say paying back Pell Grants in the interview, and you don't pay back Pell Grants. What I meant to say was paying back the loans that students take out to complete their education. And I personally know 40-year-olds who are still paying back their loans, and it's just awful, just terrible that they're still in that predicament. Well, I wanted to give you some contact information for the Education Trust, 3ws.edtrust.org. That's one word, EdTrust. And then, of course, for the College Results Online, which Jennifer talked about, 3ws.collegeresults, all one word, .org, collegeresults.org, and that's Jennifer's contact information and contact information for Education Trust. But I also wanted to let you know that there's an Education Trust West, and you can access that by the 3Ws, edtrust.org/west, and there is a report out from them that I wanted to share with you. Oakland, California, the College Board released the results of the 2009 Advanced Placement, or AP, tests earlier this week, with their 6th annual AP report to the nation. This is a quote: "These AP results serve as yet another example of how California schools are failing to teach our African American and Latino students to the highest levels. And they are another indicator of the wide and pervasive achievement gaps that plague our state." And this is a quote from Arun Rasmuthan, Executive Director of the Education Trust West. And, you know, what they're trying to achieve is equity among students. And they're saying equity among students must mean that the demographics of students who take and succeed on AP tests reflect the demographics of our public schools. This is certainly not the case in California, where Latino and African American students are underrepresented as AP test takers and even more underrepresented as successful test takers, those who score a 3 or above on at least one test. And of course, Jennifer addressed that in her interview with us. And they go on to say that despite some notable progress, stark equity and excellent gaps remain. In raw numbers, Latino and African American students participating in advanced placement coursework and tests has increased over the past 5 years. Yet even with those increases, only 12% of the state's African American 12th graders took at least one AP exam, and only 4% succeeded with a score of 3 or higher. And just 20% of Latinos took an AP exam this year, with only 12% succeeding. It must be additionally noted that for California's Latinos, much of their success is on the AP Spanish language course rather than in a content area such as calculus or history. Moving forward, districts can address the AP access gap by ensuring universal free access to the PSAT in the 10th grade. Education can then systematically utilize the results to decrease the number of African American and Latino students who languish in low-level classes. Data from the PSAT would allow schools and districts to better identify students that belong in more rigorous AP classes and help reduce tracking based solely on a student's demographics. And then this is another quote from Rasmuthan: "Right now, there is unprecedented momentum in our nation and in our state to turn the tide of education for the students who have been historically underserved by our public schools. This presents a great opportunity as well as a moral imperative to move beyond the mere analysis of data toward the implementation of real and radical reforms. The data is not new, but the practices we put in place to address the data and the needs of our students should be concluded." And that's her quote, or the quote by Rasmuthan. And so I hope that you will check out that website, Education Trust West, edtrust/west, especially if you're interested in the results in California. I still much prefer the idea that President Obama has, when I listened to a White House chat on the net on Tuesday, and I heard them talking about, yes, they were very interested in using the community colleges for the first 2 years, especially here in California. And I think that is just such a great solution to this problem. And I know that the prestige isn't there, but what's more important, the student or the prestige? So that's somewhere place where I disagree with Jennifer, although I don't know if it's so much disagreement if she could see that those community colleges were indeed getting the money to do the work that they need and to hire the teachers or keep the teachers and not losing money. And so that's something that we need to look at for sure. And when I was listening to the message from Arnie Duncan, the president from the President's Council on Education on Tuesday, they talked about Pell Grants, they talked about Perkins, they talked about the college access and completion funds. And these are all things you can look up: college access and completion funds and tuition tax credits. And I feel some great hope there. And maybe I'm just being optimistic, but I don't think so. I'm very hopeful about the progress of this, that we're going to be making in this area. Well, now we're going to take a music break, and I'm going to share with you from Lumiere by Chris Williamson a great song, Midnight Oil, because we don't want to let the midnight oil burn low, and especially with this issue. And then I'll be back. And I hope that you are going to the Facebook page and making comments there, because I can comment back to you, and we can have a conversation. So do join me there on Facebook. So here we go with a little music break. Here we go.
Don't let the midnight. Things turn out in the end.
was a sort of sigh, a great letting go.
Well, welcome back, and I hope that you enjoyed that little music break. That was from the album Lumiere by Chris Williamson, titled Midnight Oil. Don't let the midnight oil burn low. And I was thinking about that because it's easy to get discouraged right now, the way that things are going, and so we can't let the midnight oil burn low. We have to hang in there. And I want to give you some more information on this topic. First of all, from a website, 3wsusstudents.org, that's usstudents, all one word, .org. State aid reform. For decades, big banks have boosted profits by issuing student loans. They do this by aggressively marketing loans to students that seem great up front, but have high interest rates and rigid repayment plans on the back end. Consequently, the average student borrows is graduating a whopping $23,000 in debt. In response, the Obama administration has proposed a plan to change the student loan system so that it promotes college affordability over private profits. The Student Aid and Fiscal Responsibility Act, which passed the U.S. House of Representatives in September, embodies this change by ending the Federal Family Education Loan Program, or FFELP, which will save an estimated $87 billion and funnel those savings into need-based financial aid like the Pell Grant. This bill has stalled in the Senate, and we need you to help to get it moving. So they ask that you go there and you download the Reclaim Education toolkit, Invest in Our Nation, and to show to legislators and administrators how much students are paying by building the wall of student debt, which is a site on the website, and hold your federally elected officials accountable by sending a letter or lobbying their district office, and you can take action on that website, and make your voice heard by submitting a letter to the editor or an opinion editorial, and they give you ways of doing that as well on this website. That's 3wsusstudents.org. This is towards student aid reform. And then also, as I told you, I listened in on Arne Duncan's message to who is the education chairperson for President Obama, and I listened to his hour address and taking questions from people who were listening in on Facebook, which I hope you're doing now as well, and sending me messages there on our Facebook page here at Education Now. And I'm just so happy to take your questions and or to hear your responses. And so I want to tell you about a website. This is the Ed Voice, and edvoice.org is a pretty good site. And here you find they're talking about a new documentary, which I posted on the Education Now website, at the Facebook website, at any rate, on our Facebook page. And they ask that you watch the documentary on the new EdVoice website, www.edvoice.tv, to learn more about early this year, Senator Gloria Romero here in California led a bipartisan coalition that pulled off a rare feat in Sacramento. They put kids first, and it couldn't have happened without an education supporters like the people, the parents, the students, and everyone. Now, a lot of people feel that this is just political jive. But I want you to look at it critically and before you make up your mind. And they say that thanks to thousands of letters, phone calls, and visits to legislative offices, California answered President Obama's call for bold reform in the federal race to the top. And that thanks to the effort, kids stuck in schools that have failed their communities for decades will have a way out to a better public school. Real change will be mandatory in school turnarounds. Rearranging the deck chairs will no longer be an option. And parents will have power to make this happen in their communities. I especially liked that statement. Parents will have power to make change in their communities. And they ask that you send any feedback or questions to betterschools@edvoice.org. So that's from the EdVoice team, and I hope that you'll take a look at it and not be too cynical, which I know it's easy to become cynical today with the way that things are going in education, especially in public education. It can be quite scary. But I do think that there are solutions, and that if we came, you know, we were second in the nation, which you heard me say, you heard me tell Jennifer that California was second in the nation only to New York in the 60s and 70s, and it was free for everyone. All the way through college, it was free. And so we know how to do it. It isn't a question that we don't know how to do it. We do know how to do it. But when they take down affirmative action, and when they do everything they can to prevent the children and families of people who really built this country from being able to succeed, then what hope can there be? And so, don't give up. Well, this is Education Now, of course, and I'm Athena Melville, your host, and I want to tell you what's happening next on Education Now. On Thursday, March 18th, Education Now will podcast an interview with Belinda Rollins. Yes, on Thursday, March 18th, Education Now will broadcast an interview with Belinda Rollins, who is with the Transmission Project, which is part of VISTA, or Volunteers in Service to America. Belinda has been on Education Now before, when she was the general manager of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, and she was really midwife to Education Now. She was there at its inception, and we're going to be doing a focus on the media and education, which is so important. A free media is so important to a free people and so important to education. It cannot be overemphasized, and so it's going to be a great show, and I hope that you will be joining us for that show on March 18th at 7 o'clock here on Education Now for that podcast. And then on April 1st, we'll have a show with Mary Pat Palmer, herbalist, and who's also been a guest before, and I'm so excited about that interview. And then in April, on mid-April, the third Thursday in April, May Sakharov will be, Dr. May Sakharov will be my guest. That's on April 15th, and we're going to be, May and I are going to be focusing on online learning, and I'm very excited about that show as well. And so thank you so much for joining me here on Education Now. I want to especially thank Christopher Melville, whose help has just been so exceptional in helping me do these podcasts and starting to do two shows a month. I just couldn't do it without him. So thank you so much to Christopher. And of course, Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education. a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, and we thank them. And I thank you for joining me tonight, and I hope that you are accessing us on the Facebook page, or that you are sending me messages on our website on my email address, which is hermes@pacific.net. That's H-E-R-M-E-S. @pacific.net. I hear from most of you by email at my hermes@pacific.net address rather than the Facebook page, where we could have a conversation. But if that is what you prefer, that is all right with me too. Thanks again and for joining me tonight, and I look forward to being with you again on Thursday the 18th with our interview with Belinda Rollins on the media and education. I don't want to leave this podcast this evening without telling you to be sure that you check the news to see how the marches and demonstrations went today, March 4th. They were demonstrating all over California, marching and in Sacramento about all the cuts and pink slips in education on the universities, all of public education. So check that out. Find out what's going on. Get involved. Our children, education is a premium. And you know, people come to this country to go to our universities because they're so superior. But we should be sure that our own children get in as well. And especially all of those children who don't have the means. That's what it's all about, people. So thanks again. And you know, you can always listen to any show here on Education Now by going to our website, where you must be to be listening right now. And there's a free downloads if you'd like them, or just to listen. And we thank you so much for being with us tonight. And we hope that you enjoyed the show, and I'm really looking forward to my next show with Belinda Rollins and the media and education, and I look forward to your feedback. So do contact me either through the Facebook page or my email address, hermes@pacific.net. Thank you, one and all, and good night.